Okay. Well, tell me about yourself. Where do you come from?
I'm from Long Island in New York.
What town?
Mineola.
Mineola. Is that North Shore?
Middle of it. Nassau County in the middle.
Uh-huh.
So right outside, right about the tree line, you know, when the houses uh-huh. had a little bit of grass on them.
Right, yeah.
So grew up there, went to Manhattan College in the Bronx, mm-hmm. went down to Rutgers for my PhD in microbiology.
Yeah, well, tell me a little bit about early schooling. You developed a interest in science somewhere. Where did that happen?
Yeah, I think that pretty much happened, I think, probably even in grammar school. I was interested in being a scientist, you know, and those kids with the chemistry stead, always blowing stuff up and mixing things and taking stuff apart. Didn't have the mathematical strength, I guess, to become an engineer, and biology was always my love, so sort of just followed my love in biology into microbiology.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Did you get any encouragement at home?
A lot of emphasis at home on education. They did weren't college graduate, my parents weren't, but they were going to make sure we all were. So there was a lot of encouragement for that. Sent us to a prep school on the Long Island called Chaminade. So you were geared to go to college. So.
Good.
Thank you.
Got it.
Thank you. I'd like to order a salad. I think of the marinated vegetables.
You got it? Thanks. Was that it?
Nothing for me, thanks. I already ate.
All right, I'll grab these.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So yeah, Chaminade prep school, a lot of encouragement to go to college, pursue a degree. So I had a lot of economic and emotional support
mm-hmm.
and growing up for advanced education.
Yeah, did you have an idea going to college that you were going to study microbiology?
Yeah, I was interested in biology, and then I met a professor there who was a microbiologist, and he became an early mentor of mine, and I did some independent research with him. And sort of became enamored with microbiology, and then
what about it was appealing? Did you do any actual work?
Yeah, I tell you the truth, I didn't like torturing animals. I didn't like playing with mice and rats. I did some of that, and it just didn't seem as much fun. At least with microbes, you could run experiments and get data, but you didn't have to cut anything up to do it. So
sure.
That's sort of what I enjoyed about it. So it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Then really got into micro for my PhD at Rutgers.
And going there, did you have a notion that you would pursue this as a career?
Yes, I wanted to become an industrial microbiologist. My father had become ill with cancer, and I wanted to develop medicines. So it sort of became, I guess, an underlying psychological drive was to work hard and develop.
So you thought you'd go into pharmaceuticals,
yeah. So I had no inclination whatsoever to go into academics. I knew I was going to get a PhD and go to work in the pharmaceutical business.
Uh-huh.
So that was sort of had a clear path that I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And studied industrial enzymes there. Why didn't I study something more applicable to, drug development? Well, you know, I met a guy named Dr. Douglas Evely, who was very personable, persuasive, wonderful human being, a very, very close friend to this day, and decided I'd go work with him, and he was working on industrial enzymes, which in retrospect was a wonderful twist of fate, because this was before recombinant technology.
Mm-hmm.
And when recombinant technology came, the ability to produce proteins out of microorganisms was a skill set that people wanted.
Right.
So that became, I got lucky. You know,
you
studied something that all of a sudden went from sort of an edgy, not so interesting area to sort of the mainstream of what they needed to do recombinant technology. So.
Yeah, so your thesis work was, are you working on an enzyme, purifying an enzyme?
Yeah, purifying an enzyme from fungi for the degradation of a polymer that's on the cell walls of fungi. So what we were trying to do was use this enzyme as a therapeutic to stop fungi infecting burn wounds. And they were getting a lot of burn wounds. This is Vietnam War. Dropping napalm on people. Sometimes they drop it on their own people. They drop it on innocent civilians. So burn wound research is being funded by the U.S. Army. So I was funded by the U.S. Army to work on a cell wall degrading enzyme from a fungus.
And so was Evely at that time?
Yeah, that's what he had. He was my advisor, and that was his grant. So did that for a couple of years. I was lucky enough to get out of school very quickly. 3.5 years I got my PhD. This experiment's worked.
So, and you're serious about this? You're putting in a lot of hours?
Yeah, working pretty hard, but I won't pretend it was all slave. Graduate school is fun. You know? Yeah. I look back and say, why did I rush through that time so much? That was the best time of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't have any money, but no one else did. You didn't even notice, right? You just had a lot of friends and a lot of good times. So. And then he hooked me up with an interview over at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in Groton, Connecticut.
So he had industry connections.
He did. Most of his graduate students went into industry. So I went up there and...
Did that have anything to do with your selection of him as a mentor at Rutgers?
Well, yeah.
Did you go to Rutgers for him?
I went to Rutgers for him. But Rutgers was known as an applied microbiology school.
I see.
I had opportunities for other schools like Columbia and schools like that, but they weren't applied micro, and I always, like I said, wanted to go into industry, so I wanted to go to an applied school.
And you didn't care about academic prestige?
Nah, you know, so. Right, exactly. Rutgers
is okay.
It's okay, good enough. Who needs Columbia? You know, not State University of New Jersey, but Ed Rutgers has a good name.
Yeah.
And it's known for its microbiology. Selman Waksman discovered and developed streptomycin there. So that was
he there? Still there at the time?
He had gone.
40s or 50s.
He was gone, but you still had that, you know, the history of developing drugs out of this school.
Yeah.
So that's what connected with me. I was like, oh, they got antibiotics came out of here. So then I went up to Pfizer, worked there for about 3 years. Recombinant DNA started.
What year did you get your PhD?
1977.
Okay, so this stuff is in the works.
It's in the works, but not really hitting the fan yet. You know,
did Genentech, you know about Genentech?
Yes, started. I mean, you had to be asleep in science not to know about them. I mean, I kind of watched them, knew a few people had gone work there. And Pfizer was just kind of slow on picking it up, so I got a little impatient, being a young, impatient young man, and started looking around and answered an ad in Chemical Engineering News, you know, the little blurb that said, Applied Molecular Genetics Seeks Scientists. And in that 20th anniversary book, I don't know if you got it, they actually kept the ad and they put it in the book.
Do you know who placed the ad?
Yeah, George Rathman and Susan Hirsch, you know. And then I went on my interview. No, he called me up and said, come on out. So I said, sure, California, I'll come out. So got on a plane, flew out here. And I thought I'd get to see a company. Instead, I just met a guy, George Rathman.
Yeah, where did you meet him at?
In Building 1 of Amgen.
And there were how many buildings at that time?
There was one third of one building. We shared it with Continental Singers and a ball bearing company.
Uh-huh.
And it was just this tilt-up concrete building in a warehouse, you know, in an industrial park.
Did it have... This is about a year after the company was officially founded.
Yeah, about a year after it. And you know, I knocked on the door, and he answered himself. And I thought there was going to be actual scientists there. And on that day, he had hired a couple of people, but no one was there. It was just him.
Uh-huh. So no lab there? Or?
No, nothing. Just the offices. They were starting to design the labs. And, you know, I thought I'd be giving a presentation to a bunch of scientists. So I brought my overheads, remember those things, with my publications, my patents, and all this stuff. Instead, I sat down with George, and for 3 hours he convinced me, trying to convince me I should come and join him. So that went, he was a persuasive guy, but...
Yeah. Was anybody at Pfizer talking about this stuff?
There were two or three guys. They had hired two molecular biologists, but they were in this other... They were in this place you couldn't go, and it was, they were very conservative in their approach to it. They were just sort of toying in it, and I could see they were never really going to lean into it, and they never did, right? They had to buy Wyeth to get recombinant...
Yeah, 20 years later.
20 years later, right? And, I just had arguments with my vice president. He told me, it's a quote I love, he said, proteins will never be therapeutics. Your job is to go and help chemists be successful. It's a small molecule company you work for. And I went,
quote. That's, we can use that one.
That's today.
Right here, thanks.
I was like, all right. That's all right. That's a small molecule company you work for. I'll put my resume out. I'm only 28 years old. I'll go somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting time.
It was.
You were convinced that the technology was going to work. I mean, nobody had actually...
You know...
They hadn't even, at this time, they just cloned insulin.
They had just cloned it. So, I, you know, was I convinced? No, but I was excited about the technology. Who knew if it was going to work back then, right? You know, it was unproven.
Well, Pfizer, that's a pretty, you got a pretty good job there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people thought I was nuts leaving a good job to go to work for a crazy company.
Who are the people who told you you were nuts?
Everybody worked at Pfizer with me.
Yeah.
I made sure I didn't burn any bridges and was respectful on the way out. And another quote from the same individual was, I was like Icarus, and I was going to get too close to the sun and my wings would melt and I'd come crawling back from my job. So I said, well, maybe. I hope not. You know, so luckily that didn't happen.
What did George Rappin say to you in your meeting?
Yeah, you know, he was quite I don't know if you ever met George, but sure his reputation is there. He was an incredibly charismatic, very, very loquacious, very well-spoken.
Okay. Yeah, good, thanks.
Guy, and literally it was a two-hour monologue. I sat there just nodding my head, and you know, he asked me a few questions like, why do I want to leave Pfizer, and you know, and but mainly he was just telling me he was going to build the biggest fully integrated pharmaceutical company that was going to be bigger and better than Pfizer. He said that, and I looked out the window and there was a bunch of dirt, you know, and I thought this guy was nuts. So I went home and my wife said, how was it? I said, it's just, the guy's nuts. He thinks he's going to build a big company. He's got nothing but, he's got $18 million. I think that was the amount.
And did you know about his background?
Yeah, Abbott? He told me about it, Abbott. You know, this was before the internet, so you kind of didn't know much about him. I knew he was the vice president of Abbott and knew he was a scientist by training. But that's about it. And when I met him, he was very, you know, he was somewhere, you know, when you think back, when you're trying to put your mind back to where it was, you know, he was either crazy or he was brilliant, one or the other, and you didn't know, right?
Yeah.
And you're just like, well. So a couple of weeks.
He was a chemist, right?
Yes.
Training.
Yeah, right. From Princeton. I think he was a physical chemist from Princeton, then he went to 3M. Spent most of his career at 3M. Mm-hmm. Head of research there, and then on to Apple. Then on to Litton, I think, for a little while, and then to Amgen. Mm-hmm. And so
did you have to convince your wife about
well, this? That's where we're going. Okay. So a couple of weeks later, I figured that's the end of it. He calls me up and he says, well, what do you think? I said, well, George, I got a job. This is pretty risky where you're asking me to go. You know, I went to another company for an interview, GeneX. They have like a real labs and 250 people. And the company went out.
Oh, you did go?
To GeneX, not Gen.
Well, tell me about that, too.
I just went for an interview there because they were doing a lot of similar work to what I was, industrial enzymes, applied microbiology, transformation. It's more of the chemical side of things. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy I know who was working there.
So who's that?
Now you're going to Steinberg or something like that. He was just a scientist. I can't remember.
Met Les Glick?
I did for like 35 seconds on my interview, you know, the quick walk by and shake hands, come join us.
Who else did you talk to there?
That guy who's in charge of the industrial enzyme group and a bunch of scientists, and the names are all gone, I'm sorry. Can't remember. Mm-hmm. So that was an offer I had.
That one didn't appeal?
Yeah, well, it was all right. I was thinking about it. And then George came, and then he calls me back and he says, why don't you come back and this time bring your wife? And I'm friggin' great. A vacation in California. Mm-hmm. So we leave Hartford, Connecticut, and it's, you know.
So have you been out here before to California?
Yes. And I give you that story. When I saw the interview, when I saw the ad, it said Newberry Park, California was where it said. Mm-hmm. And I remember because I had stopped for lunch in Newberry Park, California, taking a trip up the ride. So California had a major attraction for me, you know. The beach, the sand, Zuma Beach up the road a piece. You know, after my interview, I went and looked at that and said, this is a beautiful place, you know, if it works. So we got off the plane here. We left there. It was like 30 degrees, sleeting. Got off the plane. It was 80 degrees here and beautiful. And my wife saying, so what about this job you don't like? So she was encouraging me to take it as well. Mm-hmm. And
how old were you at this time?
I was 29, almost 30. So
you got to start getting serious, but you still have...
Yeah, I got time. No kids. So, and, you know, the department I was working at Pfizer had a lot of old guys talking about how many years they had to retirement. Everybody was sort of... It wasn't exciting enough for me.
and when working for the government.
When I came back the second time for George, with George Ram, for Applied Molecular Genetics, rather, there were a couple scientists there. He had, you know, hired a few more people. This was maybe another month or two later, and people were there, and I did really interview people. It was like a mutual interview. I'm interviewing them. I trust these guys. They look smart, and they were smart.
We are good people. Do you remember who it was?
Larry Souza. Sid Suggs, Bruce Wallace. MGen's first employee was Bruce Wallace. I interviewed with him and George, and I think that's it. An RA researcher named Henry Shea. He left MGen a year, number of years. But I mean, there were people, and there was a lab, and there was stuff. There was an autoclave. Things happening.
Did they tell you what they were doing? What was their...
Yeah, okay, they were doing everything. I mean, he was going to apply this technology broadly everywhere. You know, we're going to do transformation of chemicals into higher value chemicals. We're going to do diagnostics. We're going to do therapeutics. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a technology looking for an application, basically, when you think about it. You know, yeah. He was just going to try everything. So, took the job.
Did you think about any of those applications and think, well, maybe this is a good idea, this will work?
Yeah, I mean, again, I wasn't certain. There was a lot of risk. No one knew for sure whether or not the thing would work. Would the FDA approve a drug from a recombinant organism? That was in the air. Could you grow recombinant organisms on a large scale, or would they have to, you know, would they prevent? You remember the 10-liter rules back then? You only could grow it into 10 liters. But I took the chance, you know. You can't say I was certain, but, you know, then I hung out, and it was a day like today after the interview, and I said, what's the worst that can happen? I go back to New Jersey, and I beg for a job at Roche or, you know, Pfizer back there. I go work for some other pharma company, and maybe I know something about recombinant technology, and maybe they'll be interested by that point. Mm-hmm. So I figured maybe it'll go 5 years, and I'll be back east, which is probably what my relatives and my mother and everybody else wanted, was, you know, for you to come back.
So, yeah, it's a long way.
It is.
Longer then than it is.
Oh, yeah, it seemed like the other end of the world back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
so
they brought you out here to make stuff, but they didn't have anything to make.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
exactly. So I showed up and I said, George, what's my job? And he goes, this is another quote I'll never forget. I don't know, Dennis, but you're going to have to figure it out. And I was like, okay. So no one had cloned anything yet. And I was just running around seeing what I could do to help people. And it wasn't very long. It was a period of maybe a month or so before they started having their first clones. It took me, you know, 6 months to get some fermenters in. I had to buy 10-liter fermenters and get those and put them in.
Were you at Pfizer long enough to sort of know your way around the whole business?
Or? No, not at all. Okay. I had a very narrow lab experience of scaling up things at Pfizer. So I was learning as I was going. You know, I'd never bought a fermenter before. Mm-hmm. Pfizer just had big stainless steel stuff we used.
Yeah.
And they weren't from New Brunswick. There was stuff they had made back in the 50s and 60s before I got there.
So George Rathman must have known that you didn't have an enormous amount of experience, but now...
But I had a lot of confidence, I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. So I go do it. I think George hired a lot of young men who were very eager, confident, brash, you know, annoying perhaps, but we just went and did it. You know, if we knew how hard it was going to be, we never would have tried, but we just did it.
Yeah.
That was great fun. Mm-hmm. So, bought some fermenters, set them up, first fermentation. My first lab was a closet, because they hadn't designed anything into the buildings they were built, but there was a closet that about 6x6, I slammed some fermenters in there and attached it to the steam generator that ran the autoclave, and when they weren't running the autoclave, I could sterilize my fermenters.
Mm-hmm.
And started growing E. coli. The original E. coli didn't even have an insert in it. It was just growing E. coli to figure out how to grow E. coli. Mm-hmm. You know, no one was growing E. coli back then. So
how did that go?
Yeah, it was new. It was different. It was the different organisms. They're rapidly growing, you know, in a traditional world of big pharma, we were very slow growing stuff and streptomyces and penicillin for antibiotics. And I remember that you inoculated and you were done in 8 hours. It used to take 5 days for a fermentation back at Pfizer. You know, you could go home and go to bed and come back and take a sample. Mm-hmm. So this was a lot faster. And it went well. So we had a lot of good times in the early days, and Kirby Alton was hired, started a few weeks before me, and Larry Souza was earlier than him. And then Larry and, I'm sorry, Kirby and Dan Vapnick came together because Kirby had worked with Dan at Georgia. And so they showed up, and it was an impressive group of young people. We were, you know, taking a shot.
So when you first put a gene in E. coli, what was it? What was the first one?
You know, that's going to be a good question, and Kirby might remember better than me. We were working on things like beta endorphin. We were working on calcitonin. We were working on, of course, gamma interferon. They developed a consensus alpha interferon. That was early. But the first ones, I'm pretty sure, were like beta endorphin or calcitonin. Some weird things like that. They never were products.
Yeah, that's interesting. So there were research meetings. How big was the company?
There were 20 of us. So the research meeting, we were all in one big office. So research meetings were continual. You know, there was no, all staff meetings were every day. And George was there every day in those days most of the time. And, you know, he was very, very active. And
so he knew everything that everybody was doing.
He used to come around the labs. And he'd ask you, what are you doing? And, you know, it's okay. That was how, you know, I left Pfizer where I did a monthly, a quarterly, a six-weekly report. All I did was in my office, you know, writing reports, it seemed. Mm-hmm. And here there was no written reports at all, but George went around. And I remember one time I told him what I was doing, and he looked at me and he said, you told me that last week. You better have something new when I come next week. And I was like, uh-oh. He actually remembers what I told him.
And who was influential in terms of, were you discussing, when you have meetings, you're discussing, okay, is this scientifically possible?
We had a scientific advisory board that was very influential. So those,
how often did they?
They came in about once a quarter. And those people in the early days were very, very helpful in target selection, solving real problems people were having on the molecular biology side. When I gave my presentations to the SAB, they were kind of, you know, who wants to hear about fermentation and recovery of these organisms, you know, the products? They're not so interested in all that.
There's nobody on the scientific advisory board?
There was no Charlie Cooney, who was an advisor to Genentech.
Right.
We didn't have one of those.
Was he Genzyme? Was he doing Genentech too?
He was Genentech in the beginning.
Really?
Before Genzyme.
I didn't know that.
Before Genzyme.
Okay.
Yeah. He was also an advisor I had at Pfizer. He was making the rounds at all of them. Yeah.
So, and he was at MIT at that time.
Yes, he was.
Uh-huh.
A young professor at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there weren't really a lot of chemical engineers then. They were just starting to train those folks for biochemical engineering.
Yeah.
And MIT was one of the first places to do it.
So, did you run into problems, you know, with the bugs? And
phage, you know, they're phage sensitive, which is this virus. So, you know, you get a viral infection and your cell density would go to zero. It would go like that and down, and it would foam out, and the fermenter would explode, and it was all kinds of fun times.
And then, I mean, if you got a virus, then you got to tear everything apart.
Apart and clean it, exactly. And we used to do this terrible treatment with formaldehyde, where you'd steam it into the room. But then, you know, working with the molecular biologist, God bless him, I told them that this isn't going to scale, and they went away and found a phage-resistant one. You know, they kept screening against phages till they found one that wasn't very susceptible to any of the phages, and so we got rid of that problem.
Mm-hmm.
That was very helpful.
So did you ever grow products in E. coli?
Sure. Amgen's Neupogen product is an E. coli-based product. Mm. Yeah. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We had a couple of them. Interferon. I mean, we put a lot of products into clinical trials of E. coli, and the one that came out first was Neupogen. Neupogen is E. coli-based.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, EPO is a mammalian cell product. Mm-hmm. So it was lots of fun. Mm-hmm. Thinking back on those days, it was crazy long hours, a lot of hard work, but a lot of. It didn't feel like work, is what it felt like. You were doing something important, and you didn't notice that you were working 12 hours a day every day.
Were you at the same place where the campus is now?
Yep. Yep. That's where we got lucky. We occupied four buildings for quite a while, which were right across the street from each other. Then we put our Epogen plant down the block. Again, we were just an industrial park, so we were just able to people would pretty easily move out. There was a Rolls Royce dealership. They stored their cars, so we took that building over. They just put the cars in another building somewhere else. So,
yeah.
And we were able to grow into that. And Northrop, I think it was Northrop, no, Raytheon, had a large complex right there. And, of course, the fence went in the toilet just as Amgen was growing in the mid-late 80s. And we were able to just expand into their buildings. As they pulled out, we moved into them. So we were lucky to be able to stay there and develop that campus.
Yeah. You joined in 81?
Yes.
I was looking at the red herring for the IPO,
mm-hmm.
and there's a plan in there. This is early 83, right?
Right.
There's a plan for a 40,000-foot production facility.
Mm-hmm. In Chicago.
Was it in Chicago? Is that what, did that come about?
No, it didn't. It was an interesting thing. George calls me into his office and says, "Hey, Dennis, we're going to build a plant in Chicago." And I look at him and I'm like, you know, the company's like 50 people at the time. And I'm like, "Chicago, George, what are you, nuts?" He goes, "You go where the money is." So he had, the mayor of Chicago was willing to guarantee some loans to Amgen. And because of that.
Are you afraid he was going to send you back to ice and snow? Or?
Yeah, I didn't want to go to Chicago. That was clear. So my first job was to hire some people who wanted to go to Chicago, and I did. And that's Bob Andron, if you ever get a chance to talk to him.
I talked to him on the phone just briefly when he was setting up.
Yeah, I hired him, and he was then going to go off and build the Chicago facility. And it was funny because we didn't have anything to make. So how do you design a plant when you don't have any products? Mm-hmm. It was quite a challenge.
Yeah.
So we ended up designing it.
Did it make sense to you?
Well, I think it was, to be diplomatic, since the tape is running, I think it was very beneficial for the IPO to be able to say you were putting a manufacturing plant together.
I think that George had that in mind?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because as soon as the IPO was completed, let's just say the focus on the manufacturing plant sort of decreased.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then when the time when we actually did clone EPO, we weren't going to Chicago to put it up. We were building it 100 feet down the road in Building 6. So I don't know how much is George using this as a lever for the IPO or not, or whether or not events just overtook us. At the time, in retrospect, it looked perfectly clear we were never going to build a plant in Chicago, but I don't know that. I don't know what everybody's intent was at the time.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, EPO, was EPO a big focus in the company?
In the early days, not so much. It became clear that it was an opportunity for us. And Fu Quinlin, you connected with him, I hope. And,
yeah.
he'll give you the whole story. He was the first team leader on that project and the gentleman who did clone EPO. So I'd say we were doing a whole lot of other things, gamma interferon, consensus interferon, porcine growth hormone, all kinds of things, but there was obviously a lot of a constraint point with my fermenters in the production of stuff. And he always told me EPO was number one, and everybody else is equal at number two. So he always knew that EPO was sort of could be the thing we built the company on. And as you know, it was a very competitive race with GI, and we ended up beating them by a couple of weeks. So,
and was there a sense of that competition?
Yes, very much so. There was a tremendous sense that we better get going, and Fu Quinn wasn't having much success in the lab, and he can tell you, but it was a brute force effort. That gentleman worked 24 hours a day for months. I mean, the urban myth is that he slept in the lab. Well, I don't think it's true, because I never saw him sleep.
Yeah.
I just saw him be there all the time, and he put a tremendous effort, he and his technician. And they used probes, and they finally picked it out and got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And during this, while this is going on, when did they know that, oh, we're going to have to express this in mammalian cells? Sure.
Is there a menu or anything, guys?
Okay, thank you. I think, if I recall correctly, we put it both in E. coli and mammalian cells. We put the insert into both.
Yeah.
And then we found out it had to be glycosylated to be active, so then it was a clear decision.
Uh-huh. Was that interesting to you? Had you worked with mammalian cells?
No, I had not. And I, at that point in Amgen's history, I wasn't responsible for that piece of production. I was on the microbial yeast, Bacillus, E. coli side. There was another group. And
there was one yeast guy on the scientific advisory board.
There was, John Carbon.
Yeah, was he involved in all these?
Yeah, he was. And there was, he had one of his students named, a guy named Grant Bitter, who, and another guy named Ray Koski. So there were two yeast geneticists there. Because no one knew which system was going to work, right? There was even a Bacillus guy, a Mark Zukowski. So there were a couple of E. coli guys, a couple of yeast guys, a couple of Bacillus guys, and mammalian cell molecular biologists as well.
Mm-hmm. So you're head of the department, yeah? Or the...
Yeah, I'm a lab head with some title like that. Uh-huh. Yeah, back in about, you know, when VPO was cloned and expressed.
And so you're building a team. You like doing that? That was appealing to you?
Yeah, that was fun. It was fun. You know, it was about that time you sort of... Amgen was growing quickly after EPO was approved. You kind of have to make your mind up whether or not you wanted to
after it was approved. This is several years later.
Later. Oh, okay, yeah. So you're still in that point. You asked me, yeah, I'm building a small team, but I'm still, let's just say I'm still in the lab.
Yeah.
You know, I have, you know, four PhDs, but I got a lab bench and a technician myself.
So you're just thinking about how to scale this up.
Right, right.
And in fact, you don't need to scale it up that much, right? I mean,
luckily for us, the dose of EPO turned out to be micrograms, not milligrams. So we were able to use the lab process, roller bottle process, to scale it, and we just multiplied the number of roller bottles. We didn't take the time, and this was a big point of debate with George, to take it into suspension culture. You know, people wanted to do that work. It was sort of cutting-edge technology. And George said, nope, we're going to scale it with just the number of roller bottles because we don't have time. We're in a rush.
Was it time or money? I mean,
it was both. But his point was, look, we don't know how this patent thing is going to... Remember, the patent's unclear still. And he says the first guy to get it to the market is going to have an advantage. You know, it's unlikely they'll take a product off the market that's approved. So his thought was, we got to beat them... Hopefully we're beating them on the patent, but that's unclear. But get to the market first. Mm-hmm. So he didn't want to give any of us 3 months or anything to develop any process development. It was just take that process you got in a roller bottle, scale it up, multiply it by 1,000 roller bottles, and build a building down the block that just handles a lot of roller bottles.
Yeah. Did you have any worries that you could actually get this to work?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was technology out. People had been handling roller bottles for vaccine manufacturing. So it wasn't totally unprecedented, but this was a therapeutic protein. We had to work with the FDA. They were obviously concerned about aseptic handling where you would, you know, you got to unscrew the tap and all that. So we developed the automated machines that did it. So it wasn't people. It was all automated, and which was a great decision. And the technology worked. And in fact, when we had to build our next plant for EPO, we didn't want to change the process. We built another one in Colorado, which was really huge, that used roller bottle technology. So we never, EPO still made in roller bottles.
Is that right?
Yeah, it never got changed.
Mm-hmm. Would it make sense to do it, maybe?
I mean, we tried actually to put it in suspension culture, and we ended up making a slightly different product to the biosimilar issue. Even the experts, we didn't get the exact same product when we made it that way. It was just slightly different.
Yeah.
Different enough we couldn't call it EPO.
Uh-huh.
So we actually just canned it after investing a lot of money and actually
because
running.
Because you'd have to go through the whole approval.
We did. Well, yeah, it would be a new product. It wouldn't be EPOGEN. It would be something else. Mm-hmm. Because it was more active.
Yeah. What else was going on? And what other products are you looking at, working with?
Well, we were working with porcine growth hormone, bovine growth hormone. We were working with all the strangest thing. The first thing Amgen got famous for was on the cover of Science was indigo dye.
Oh, right.
Remember
that?
Yeah. Some scientists who were doing, try to clone naphthalene deoxyhydrogenase, and they cloned that into E. coli, and they mixed the genes up, and out came the other end was indigo, just by total accident. Mm-hmm. And it was bright blue colonies, and when they grew it in a flask, it was bright blue.
Uh-huh.
And then they figured out it was indigo. So that was our first noteworthy scientific cover of science was, we made indigo.
Exactly, you ready, guys.
Thanks. And but that never became a product, right? Did you sell it to somebody? Or
no, we could never compete with the chemical synthesis. It was just too expensive. But it was funny that was something. We spent a fair amount of time turning all my fermenters blue, making that. And just a lot of different products through the 80s and early 90s. A lot of wound healing agents. Microbiology could clone a lot of stuff by then. That was, easy to do. Now, finding the right products, right genes that would turn into products was another issue, right?
Yeah. And at some point it becomes clear that everything's riding on EPO.
Yes. We knew that EPO was going to be, if not everything, pretty much close to everything. Could we have survived if EPO didn't make it? Well, we had Neupogen coming pretty close behind it, 2 years behind. So we were lucky. We hit 2 Grand Slams in a row, and that built the company,
Yeah.
So could one of them stumble? Yeah, maybe. But it was pretty much clear that it was either Neupogen and or EPOGEN. So.
Yeah. Well, how did the company change? You growing this whole time?
It was very different. The company kept growing, doubling in size every year or two, just tremendous growth. And, the company changed. We tried to keep what was important about the company the same, which was, work hard, play hard, try to keep the values that George instilled, because he left before EPOGEN was approved. He went off and did his Icon thing, so, which was, quite a big change in the company when he left.
Well, at some point, he's not walking around the labs anymore.
Correct. In fact, he sort of disappeared doing that because he was out raising money a lot, trying to do corporate deals.
Yeah.
So that only lasted, say, 81 to 82 or 3. And once he went public, he was more of a typical CEO sort of. He'd come in and we'd do the research reviews and he'd be there and active, but he wouldn't be day to day, wandering around bugging you about what you were doing.
Yeah.
Like the fun early days.
Yeah. And you're trying to improve the process with EPO and other products? And
yeah, most of our process improvements were driven not so much by cost of goods, but because we dramatically underestimated market size. So, you build a plant that's supposed to make 50 grams, and that's, the world supply for 2 years, and it turns out the big supply for the first year. So you got to figure out how to make 100, and a plant that you designed for 50.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working very much on getting yield, productivity up.
Hold on.
No, take your time.
Yeah, okay.
No rush.
So most of the stuff, most of the early days, we were doing, COGS was not an important part back there. It was a pretty small part of, they were very profitable drugs, but it was just making enough. And so you better figure out how to get those cells more productive because you've only got a stainless steel reactor that's that big, right? So you better get it more productive.
Mm-hmm. And what did you have to do? Do you recall problems that you had or things that you tried?
The molecular biologists were excellent at, getting super promoters, higher expression level per gram. I hired some chemical engineers that were tremendously successful to get the number of cells up. So you'd only get more per cell, then you get much more cells per liter, so just more out of every reactor.
Yeah, yeah.
And we scaled up the recovery techniques appropriately. And we were pretty good. But then again, in retrospect, Amgen was lucky again. We were lucky a lot. And that we, EPOGEN and Neupogen, if we're in Embryl, we had to make tons of products. Well, that's what Immunex ran into.
Mm-hmm.
Or even TPA. Genentech had to build some really big plants to make TPA.
Mm-hmm.
Our plants were very modest investments because the dose was low.
So yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had pretty good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And were you aware of GI is your big competition?
Mm-hmm.
So are you keeping an eye on, are you wondering how are they making it? What are they doing? Did you have any idea?
Yeah, there was.
Did you talk with them?
Yeah, we go to meetings and we were careful about what we said. But I knew Mickey Koplov and some other guys who worked there. And we weren't telling each other. But I knew they were making it in suspension culture, not roller bottles. They'd make fun of me for roller bottles. And I can make fun of them now because we won we won the patent. But yeah, you know, I wasn't really that aware. I mean, the patent issue was the key issue, and we knew that was working its way through the courts, and I think it went all the way to the Supreme Court before it was resolved. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that a cause for a big celebration?
We had a lot of celebrations at Amgen. That was a big one when we won that. That was a lot of champagne was uncorked at that day early in the day.
Yeah.
That one and a lot of our arbitration victories with J&J.
That was a little later, right?
Yeah, that was in the sort of later. Yeah, not too much later, a couple of years later. You're right.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so, yeah. Amgen was always good at celebrating. It was a company that... really, you would when you played hard, and you worked hard, and you played hard. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, George Rathman left before the approval of the first drug.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of effect did that have? Was that the big event?
It was chilling. Mm-hmm. It was concerning when George announced he was leaving before EPO was approved. You know, there's a lot of stories about why he left. You know, he wasn't happy with the board, and the board wasn't happy with him, believe it or not. That's rumor and not fact.
Really?
George said that he wanted to go off to another challenge. Not sure why. He said he didn't want to run a company that was, you know, getting as big as Amgen. Okay, fine. And he left it in the hands of Gordon, who was a very, very, very different person than George. And a lot of the external things, he was very quiet. He wasn't as large a personality as George was, but he was a very steady hand on the tiller.
Yeah, do you think, would it be fair to describe George Rathman as kind of the visionary guy, but Gordon Binder's the operational guy?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, Gordon was very good with the scientist. He didn't pretend he was ahead of R&D. He also, I mean, I owe a tremendous amount to Gordon. He took a number of tremendous bets on me. I mean, he put me in charge of sales and marketing, which was perhaps one of the more insane ideas you ever thought about, putting a scientist in charge of sales and marketing.
So we'll talk about that.
Yeah, that was just nuts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he bet a lot on the people that he had a nose. Again, we were all, like I said, aggressive, certain young men who were going to go out and do things, and he would bet on us. If we believed we could do it, he'd give us a try. So, mm-hmm.
So, well, George is gone, but you have confidence in Gordon Binder, and everybody does. I mean,
the company was a little bit of a difficult time, and that, you know, there was. Harry Hickson will fill you in on a little bit more on it, but I mean, even in the 25th anniversary book, we talk a little bit about the conflict between Harry and Gordon.
And, I came across that. You know, how bad was it?
You know, in totality, at the time,
it
seemed big.
Yeah.
You know, but we were young guys and not used to having any kind of corporate intrigue.
Yeah.
In retrospect, it was relatively minor league.
Yeah, and it wasn't real bloody or
dirty. It wasn't really bloody. It wasn't like, you know, I've heard stories of Genentech from my friends there. It was nothing like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people didn't go around getting assassinated all the time because you're on the wrong side of some, some warfare event between the two guys at the top. I mean, that didn't happen. It was just uncomfortable, you know. You could tell that they weren't communicating well, we'll put it that way.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's sort of like that.
Mm-hmm. So. But that didn't affect what you were doing?
No, I worked for Harry, and Harry was a great boss. He taught me how to manage large numbers of people. He was easy to work for, and I mean that in the best of way. I mean, his expectations were clear, and if you delivered, that was fine. We didn't bother you a lot, left you for your job, and he trusted you, delegated, taught me how to delegate. Really did teach me how to delegate, because I thought I could do everything myself better than most people could, and he helped me understand that was a non-scalable, modem of operation. You gotta hire good people and let them go do their thing.
So you adapted to that?
Yeah, I adapted that and worked for Harry for a number of years, and then after Harry left, right about then is when Gordon asked me to go run sales and marketing.
Okay, well, let's talk about the sequence here and the time.
Yeah.
You start as... Your first thing is you're putting the pilot plans together.
Right.
and then at some point you become a VP. That must have been a big day.
It was. It was a big day. And I remember Harry, that was under Harry, he called me up and said, congratulations, you've been promoted. I said, I didn't even ask for it. I don't want it. You know, it's sort of like, I don't want to be a corporate officer.
Yeah.
You know?
So what did you have some notion of what that meant?
Kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of. And I was like, well, man, I'm really never going to get back to the lab now. You know,
is that something that you missed?
Yeah, sure. And in the early days, you could sort of pretend you still were a scientist because you had maybe a technician in the lab. You could run back when things got bad, you know, and get tired of the corporate nonsense. You run back and design an experiment. Probably wasn't very useful. It was probably a waste of a resource, but, you know, they did that a lot of us. Kirby had a small lab, too. And then there was sort of that day when we all got promoted, Kirby, myself, and they said, now you're running operations and you're running, clinical development, Kirby, and that's, you're in an office now. Get to work. So, yeah. So I became a VP.
But by that point, you felt you knew how to do it? You could do it?
Yeah, I knew that at Amgen I could get things done. I knew how the ropes worked and how to work the system as Amgen had developed it. So
you're inside the system.
I'm inside the system, and it turned out, I guess, that I was reasonably efficient at managing people. You know, it wasn't something I was trained to do. But I learned it. In fact, now there's a university, as a side note, called Keck Graduate Institute down in the Claremont schools I'm involved with, that we teach these kids what the business of science is, and I give lectures to them on the board, and I say, look, I've made every stupid mistake and we're going to take you, and we're going to teach you so you don't make all the mistakes I made and other people who, we're doing this learning by doing.
Tell me about some of your stupid mistakes.
All right, stupid mistake number one. These are ones will not make it onto the article, but
okay.
Maybe you could. Yeah,
it's
go ahead.
It's up to you.
No, but you'll like this one. Jones Rathman makes me an offer. My wife says, that's not enough. We need a little more money. California's expensive. A lot of these kids, my coworkers, none of them had a job. They were all coming right from postdocs. I had a real job. I had a house. I had 2 acres of land and a home. Come on. We're looking at houses right here. So I said, George, I need $10,000 signing bonus. So we don't do signing bonus, but tell you what, I'll give you 10,000 more shares. I'll double your share offer. I said, those shares are going to be wallpaper on my bathroom, George. I want some cash. Mistake number one. And then more serious ones of, evaluating people, how to put a team together, how to lead a team, all that other management leadership type stuff. You make a lot of those mistakes, along the way by, hanging on to people too long and thinking you can change them when you can't. And sometimes you got to just change your team, find roles.
Do you ever have success at changing people?
No, very rarely. Exactly. But when you're young, you think you can do that. I can change this person. They're perfect except for this fatal flaw which keeps them from being effective. And it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
And then later you realize, you're never going to turn an introverted scientist into a great leader of people if they can't do it. You can't change their personality. So you learn that. So you got to get the right people for the right jobs. So that's some of the dumb mistakes.
So as a VP, your life is very different, but you're happy,
yep, happy
running that.
Amgen's growing. It's a lot of fun. Stock's going, starting to. Stock went out. So you've seen the stock chart, right? It goes out, 18, and proceeds to sink to 4.
Right.
So they weren't happy times back before that.
Yeah.
And then Ebo hits, and then we start going back up.
Are you watching it? You've got shares. You're in at the beginning, so
right.
You've got shares. Are people in at the beginning? Are they watching that?
Well, everyone's watching it. I mean, we all in the... You're watching the share count. Your shares value going down, and it hit $4 a share, and I never forget the day that hit the lowest it ever hit. George Rathman had the misfortune of having an all-staff meeting that day, and he got a lot of tough questions and a lot of angry employees.
Well, is that also maybe a good motivator for everybody to work together?
And his words were, and I'll never forget, and I've used them in boards I'm on now. I tell the CEO, use this. No one's more upset than I am. The stock is down. I own more than you do. So sit down, be quiet. And number two, if we all do our job, it'll go up. So well, how about we all go do our job, you know, and it'll take care of itself. Stop worrying about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, you just do your job, that'll make it go up. So there's a speech he gave us to go out, and some people gave up faith and left the company, but those of us who said, you know, ride it out and see where it goes, and luckily it did go up. So yeah, so it was a happy time. Yeah, the early 90s or late 80s, happy times. Epogen, Neupogen, company's growing, you're hiring people all the time. I'm building buildings all over the place, having fun building stuff, with, you know, with laboratories and things. That was fun. So yeah, it was good.
Mm-hmm. And then you make this left turn, right?
Strange.
And this is out of the blue?
Out of the blue.
It's not something that you had thought about?
No, never thought about it. The head of sales and marketing, Paul Dawson, who was a pharmaceutical expert, had built his team. And unfortunately, he was on a ski trip and died of a heart attack. He had a bad heart, and the altitude got him. So now they're leaderless, and Amgen had been growing into two camps, the suits and the scientists. And I was always...
Caught in between, huh?
And I'm sort of a person who likes to learn something. So I didn't consider them suits. I didn't care. They were a suit and I didn't. I'd always be asking them questions like, well, how do you do that? You know, well, what's market research? You know, so I actually had some friends I played basketball with who were marketing guys. And so I was sort of in both worlds, say, because I was interested. Not that I was planning to become head of sales and marketing, but at meetings I'd actually ask them questions. And I guess Gordon noticed that I had interest in what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
And he calls me in his office one day and he says, have you ever thought about being head of sales and marketing? And I just looked at him. I said, you have a stroke? I mean, you're looking at me. I'm in shorts. I have a T-shirt and sneakers on. I don't own a suit. I can't become head of sales and marketing because you can buy a suit. And let me sleep on it. Next day, I said, well, what if I could screw this all up? I mean, this is, you know, important stuff. He said, you won't. You'll be fine. I'll help you. We'll do it together. And I said, what if I fail? He said, don't worry about it. So I felt like he was going to be there to help me, and I can learn a whole lot about something new.
Yeah.
And so I jumped. I tried it.
Yeah, that's a real unusual opportunity.
Never. Exactly.
Even in biotech.
I mean,
yeah.
One more story. So I said, look, I can't go to my PhD advisor and be totally done with science. He goes, okay, you can keep process development. So my business card was Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing and Process Development.
How long did you keep that? That sounds like a lot on your plate.
It was a lot on my plate, and so divergent in interest. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of good guys who were in process development who were very self-sufficient, and they you know, kept me informed either, you know, what was going on and over a beer informally, et cetera, but, you know, 99% of my effort was focused on figuring out what the hell sales and marketing was all about. So that stayed right to the end till I left sales and marketing, and I just went back to process development and got other stuff put back into it on the operational side.
Huh.
Yeah.
So did sales and marketing, that was fun?
It was the hardest thing I ever did. It was harder than my PhD.
It was so different.
It was so different and required me to have so many new skill sets I had to develop. You know, public speaking I could get by on, but you had to be good at it over there. You know, meeting customers, you had to be on all the time. You had to learn, you know, market segments and best pricing with, you know, the federal government. There was just all sorts of new, and they spoke a foreign language as far as I could tell, right? And I spoke a foreign language from a scientific background, but, you know, it worked. I continued to grow the drugs. If you look at Amgen's history, there's a little bend in the curve. That was when I was in charge of sales and marketing. And then it went back up another point or two when they got a real head of sales and marketing in there. But it was growing 25%. Now I can say, hey, during my 3 years in sales and marketing, I went from $300 million to $1.3 billion. That looks pretty good.
Yeah.
For a sales guy, even. Marketing.
What year was it?
That was like 92 to 95, about.
Okay, and so you've got both of the drugs on the market.
And they're going full speed ahead.
And this is the J&J stuff is going on during this.
Yeah,
period.
Did that affect you? Yeah, I was in the midst of that.
Yeah.
I've been deposed so many times by their lawyers.
Well,
we're in the middle of that war.
Well, could you give me a chronology of that whole episode? That would really help us, I think, because that's an important
deal. Harry will be better than me
because
he was full on in it. Has Gordon willing to talk to you? Did you?
No, I haven't been able to get a hold of him.
I'll see if I can get his email.
See, he's got his book, which I haven't read.
The Science Lessons book?
Yeah. There's good stuff in there from his perspective.
Yeah, okay, good. That's fine. Yeah, he might be reluctant. You know, he's a very polite person and doesn't probably want to share any conflict. You know, it was always perfect sailing, right? He's one of those people.
Yeah.
So, you know, and he probably doesn't want to get into the details. But, you know, J&J, he might. You know, we did the deal. George was... I remember the day we did the deal, I was drinking a beer, and I thought it was a great thing. We got J&J money, another $20 million, woohoo. And he said, Amgen's a weaker company today than it was yesterday, Dennis. And I went, oh, it's a deal he had to do. He wasn't ever happy with it. You know, we wanted to keep the U.S. for all indications, and they kept negotiating. We were running out of money, so George had a gun to his head and had to sign the deal. And...
That's where that split market.
Right. And they were of absolutely no help whatsoever. They were nothing but an impediment to us marching our way into good dialysis for EPO. They told us we couldn't do what we said we were going to do. They repeatedly told us we couldn't do it. And then when we did it, they sued us.
What do you mean? You said you couldn't do it. They were not permitted, or
they were saying it was impossible. The timelines we were laying out to march ourselves through a clinical trial and get the drug approved. They said the FDA will never, you know, but these guys were just big pharma types. They moved in glacial speed. They didn't understand Amgen, that we didn't need a lot of meetings. We just said, we're going to go do this.
Yeah.
And everybody ran off and did it, right? And we got clinical trial, we got it approved, and then if you look at the chronology, is when we got it approved, they sued us in the J and the FDA for collusion. So they kept this drug off the market for several months while we litigated that. That's how evil, I'll say it, evil those people were. You know, that's one thing about business, but this was beyond business, you know, with them. So it started then. It was really bad. I mean, a lot of us took every J&J product we had out of our house. Really, there'd be no J&J bandages. I mean, some of us, Mike Downing, he'll go off and he'll tell you lots of stuff. He. And George used to have, it'd be a meeting and there'd be a vase in the center. And if you complained about J&J, you had to put like $5 in the vase. And that was the deal. Because if you just complained, we all could sit there and complain all day, but that didn't get it done. So you just had to keep working. And so it was a very difficult working relationship. Now, I was supplying them drug before and after. I was in charge of manufacturing. So you can imagine, they rely on us for their drug.
And was it the case always you were doing?
Uh-huh.
That Amgen was manufacturing for them? There's never any transfer of technology to
Well,
them?
They did build their own plant in Puerto Rico for manufacturing ex-US. And we helped them start that facility.
Did they? Yeah,
and they were unable
anything
to,
about this
no.
stuff?
No. Well, some of them did. In the beginning, no. I'd say beginning, no. I had no one on the other side. But then they bought Centacor. And real grown-ups showed up that I could talk to. And that was a big change. When the Centacor people showed up, they knew what was going on. And tried to fix the plant that they were running, because they had trouble running their plant to supply the rest of the world.
And Centacor had experience with biologicals, J&J didn't.
Correct.
I'm going to hit the rest.
Go ahead, sure. I'll rest.
Why are the non-alcoholic drinks today? We don't have that.
So you must be very worried about the market during this.
Right, and they were selling into our market and trying to steal our market share, and that was cause of much arbitration battles and lots of checks going back and forth as we sold into their market and they sold into our market. IMS, you know, that group that tracks, made millions of dollars off to our legal battles.
Because you're paying them to track all
to track
them.
Everything. And, you know, the hospitals don't care. They don't care. They're going to buy either Ypres or Ypres. They don't want to keep both of them on their shelf, and they're going to use them where they use it. And then you have to track where it ends up. And then, so it was, you know, it was a flawed, flawed concept to begin with. It just wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
Even under the best of circumstances, and given the two corporations ended up hating each other, it just made it impossible.
Yeah. So. And you were deposed. You had to go testify.
Yeah, there was a lot of minor. A lot of skirmishes and a lot of battles, and poor people like Jeff Brown live with the lawyers, and I think you got his email, I hope. I don't have
I haven't been in touch with him, but I'll track him down.
See if you can get him, because he lived the J&J war. That became his life.
Uh-huh.
That poor guy.
That was his job.
He started out as the team leader for Epogen, you know. First team, and he got it approved, all those wonderful stuff, and then he spent the rest of his life fighting either the patent wars or the J&J wars. And then the poor guy, you know, just burned him out. Tough, it was tough. He retired early because it was no fun what he was doing. So.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Amgen turns out to be, of all the biotech companies, the biggest and most successful because of these two records. And if you hadn't had this weight along the way, I mean, it would be even, you know, that was a big diversion, right?
Right.
A distraction.
Absolutely. Big diversion, big distraction. You could say, and I thought it at the time, and that the battles with J&J confused everybody on the outside so much that we never got acquired because of it, you know. And it's sort of
nobody's going to pick you up.
It's a sort of a mess that they don't want to deal with, you know. So it might have, in a way, been a little armament against a hostile takeover.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before. Was there talk about that?
Not so much internally, but I just wonder why no one took Amgen out. I mean, we had these two drugs growing at this tremendous growth rate. Well, first, the patent's unclear. All right, so let's wait and see who wins the patent war. Once we won the patent war, why didn't somebody buy this? I can't explain it. So it must have been, they just looked at it and said, man, a fight with J&J, I wonder what this... Yeah, we got to take that litigation on, and what does it really mean? It must have been made us look a little ugly as an acquisition.
And maybe George Rathman leaving might have also.
Yeah, maybe. These were two cash cows. Maybe they just never believed they were going to grow to the size that they did. And then we got.
Did you know where they were going to go?
I remember the first. Poor guy passed away named Phil Whitcomb, one of Amgen's early employees. He was sort of a marketing department before there was a marketing department, business development. And his first analysis of the EPO
market... Well, he was a science guy, though.
He was. But he ended up sort of doing business development in the company in the early days. Yeah. He was never at the lab bench. He knew George from Abbott days. Actually, he was the one who got George involved in Amgen, was Phil Whitcomb.
Oh.
George came out on his... Phil was out here working with Winston Salzer, who was one of the first SAB members and the guy that the first venture capitalist approached was Winston.
Yeah, I talked to Winston.
He's
and I heard all kinds of stuff about
my goodness.
Him. What was your experience with him?
I only met him once.
Yeah.
And he was a character. And as George said, you know, half the people wouldn't come into company because he was involved. So that's why they kind of separated ways.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he left very early. I've only met him maybe once. And, he's quite a character. He makes it into the LA Times a lot, or at least he used to, because he used to run around and pick up all the open house signs and throw them in the trunk, and he had a whole garage full of them. He just didn't like them. Because they were, and then he wouldn't let the Boy Scouts, who had been crossing this piece of land to their campsites, cross it anymore, and he stopped them from doing it. So he made the LA Times a lot for being a grump.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, just on the side. But he was a strange guy, not only at Amgen, in other places.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you're VP of Sales and Marketing from 92
I'd say 3 years, 92, 95.
Uh-huh.
And then the head of...
But the J&J thing is not resolved.
Oh, no, not resolved at all. Continues.
Until what, 99?
Yeah, in 99 it continues. Yeah. The wars continue.
Uh-huh. So you got out of that.
I got out of sales and marketing. You know, you said it was hard. It wasn't natural for me. My wife said I was grumpy. My son said I was grumpy all the time. I think I was.
Were you worried that, you know, you're not really doing this right?
It just wasn't fun. Wasn't fun, like being on the ops side, building buildings, building labs, running production. It was real data. Yeah. You know, you can measure. Sales data was just, I never enjoyed as much as a true sales and marketing guy does when you're like, you sell something. It's sort of like, okay, you know, yeah, we got to do this, but it's not, it doesn't make me get up in the morning. Right? So when the head of the ops side, this guy Bob Andrin, decided to retire, Kevin Scherer was then here as the president and is my boss. We looked at each other and said, you know, I'd be a lot happier doing that job again. And
you said that to him, or he said that to you?
We said it to each other.
Uh-huh.
And no, it wasn't like he said, you can stay. No, he didn't fire me. It was just like, you can stay. But I said, no, why don't we go over there? We can hire a real head of sales and marketing, somebody from the pharma business. And if you recall, my job was to try and bridge the gap between the two parts, and I think that was by and large done.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I was there, or maybe because Amgen just sort of grew up and realized sales and marketing had a role in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was never going to be a great sales and marketing guy, so I went back to the other side, to the ops side, and we hired Stan Benson, who was from Pfizer, to run sales and marketing.
Mm-hmm. So 95, 96,
yep.
And then you go back to operations. What did you do then? It was different.
It was different. There were more products, a lot more to go, much bigger. And the big push for, say, the last 10 years of my career at Amgen was we were moving our production processes offshore to Puerto Rico to get into better tax rates. So I had to take all that technology and put it in a low infrastructure environment. We built a huge manufacturing plant down in Puerto Rico.
And
it's still there, it's still running fine, and Amgen has a low tax rate because of it.
Yeah, but there are all kinds of challenges with that, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you're moving the technology, how do you do that? Are you moving people? Or?
Right. We did it with a lot of expats. We had about 20 or 30 expats, friends of mine I convinced to go down there and have an adventure in the Caribbean and help me do this. And so we started with a small fill-finish plant, which we put in right when Depot was approved. But there was 936. Remember that tax code thing? There was
no.
A tax code that they took away. And so that wasn't so valuable anymore, but they created new tax incentives. So you had to get more of your production down there to get the incentives. So we had to actually start making the bulk as well as finish it there. And you know, the tax guys, the lawyers were all very good at that. My job was just to to move this technology down there and build large manufacturing plants to make it work. So.
Yeah, but that's difficult. Yeah.
No, but it was more of the thing.
What kind of problems do you run into?
Well, you
have
to.
You don't have trained people.
You don't have trained people. You have to hire them. You have to train them. You have to do joint ventures with the government in terms of having universities start training students in the technology you want them to. So there's a lot of schmoozing with government people. And then the challenges of actually building the plants and getting them up and running and getting them started. So it's like a, you know, 7-year, you know, major project. And so that was sort of like mainly what I did it during the last, you know, 10 years.
And run into cultural?
Yeah, cultural issues. You know, they're not like Amgen people. They tend to be a little bit more circumspect in their communication style, and you have to kind of figure out what's going on. And then we also bought Immunex, and that was a big challenge to figure out how to make Enbrel, walk into Rhode Island and fix that plant and make it work.
Were they having problems with it?
Yeah, they couldn't supply that. If you recall, what happened to Immunex was they couldn't supply Enbrel to patients. There was long waiting lists, and the stock got depressed. And so we came in and we took it over and took our expertise and fixed the manufacturing problems, and turned out to be a really good acquisition for Amgen and great for the patients. They can get the drug now.
Yeah, so were you involved in evaluating that acquisition?
Yes, they gave me one whole day to go look at the plant. And so I took a look at it and said, yeah, this one isn't very well put together or well run, just from a one-day assessment. And that was enough for Kevin, I guess. And he decided to take the jump and buy it.
Uh-huh. And that wasn't their first product. They had done other stuff, right?
They had one very small product called Leukine, which we had crushed in the marketplace with Leukogen.
Oh, that was...
They had GM CSA.
Yeah.
And that was like a $50 million product, or $100 million. That's all they had, was that, and then they had Enbrel. And Enbrel, they had 100,000 people on the waiting list. They couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. Just couldn't. The plant just wouldn't operate.
Yeah. So what did you have to do to fix that?
Bring in basic procedures, blocking, tackling, nothing brilliant. Just take I took my best people and convinced them that they wanted to go live in Rhode Island. I had to drink a lot of tequila to convince people that, you know, please go to, you know, after I took a lot of people and sent them to Puerto Rico, you know, they were looking forward to getting back. It was like World War I and II. You know, you got another war you got to go to. You got to go to Rhode Island now and get that plant going. And the people at Immunex were good. They just didn't have the experience. I mean, they just were sort of thrown into
this.
Did
you keep a lot of them?
Not too many.
Yeah.
Not that many. Some of them, yeah. I mean, it was probably 100 people. We probably have probably 20 or 30 still working there, but a lot of them just didn't want to adapt to the new culture. But new culture is, you got to care, and it's sort of, Rhode Island is sort of, say, union environment, so there's sort of a union mentality about this job.
And was that, you and Amgen had made some other acquisitions by then, you know?
We had bought Synergen,
and that
didn't
Boulder,
go so,
right?
That was Boulder, and it's a funny anecdote. There was a number of people on the ops side I really wanted to keep, and I worked personally very hard. And this is when I was in sales and marketing. I learned how to sell, so I went and sold Amgen to these people. I said, you got to stay with us. And those guys became vice presidents of my organization and operations. They were better than the people I had. So we acquired and integrated, and they won, okay? And I put them in charge of the integration with Billionaire, because I said, you're always telling me what I did wrong before when I acquired you guys. Now you're in charge of integrating those guys, and they went and did a very nice job in integrating them.
You just said the Synergen thing didn't go so well.
In terms of people were very unhappy. Well, for technology, the drugs didn't work that we acquired them for.
Yeah.
But the people we acquired on the operation side were very, very good, because they were making much larger quantities of protein than I was. The drugs they had were like BDNF and IL-1RA. Point is, they could make hundreds of kilograms, and I was still in the 10 kilogram range of stuff, and they knew how to make it bigger, so I acquired them and kept them. And it didn't go well because they didn't feel respected as we were acquiring them. They just sort of felt...
Even these ops guys who told me, hey, you're great, you're doing what you're doing?
But the rest of Amgen was, let's say, not as nice to them.
Uh-huh.
Or not as understanding.
Right.
It was a takeover. It wasn't integration of best practices. I could say the speech, but that doesn't mean that's what happened in the trenches as much as I wanted to.
Well, what were they doing? What did they know? How are they getting these kinds of volumes?
Well, they just had they had faced the challenge before we did, and we had hired some very good chemical engineers and some very good biologists who had worked together successfully as a team in process development. And these guys were better than the people I had working on some of them. And also Amgen at the time, stock was up a lot. People were, you know, coming into work in their Ferraris and sort of resting, investing. You get a lot of that, as you know, in biotech companies, any company, when they make it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people, like myself, it didn't change the way I attacked my job. Other people kind of went, well, I'm rich now, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll just sit here another year and I'll get another $1 million in stock options, you know. So, it was time for people who were more hungry involved.
Mm-hmm. So during the last 10 years you're working on, you've got Puerto Rico, Rhode Island, and you spent a lot of time in places.
Yep.
Was that fun, or
was
that
fun.
Get to be a drag?
Yeah, it was fun. It was still fun. And then we started a distribution center in the Netherlands, which is of labeling and packaging. That was a lot of fun.
What was the big product that was going in?
Well, we were moving all our products in. Leupogen, and we were Aranesp came to Europe, so all our products. We acquired that back from Roche. It was a 5-year deal. So we had to figure out how to distribute our products in Europe. which is a whole different world than here, as you know. You don't have Bergen, Brunswick, big wholesalers who ship it to all these countries. So we decided to put one distribution center in the Netherlands, which at the time was sort of risky, not too many people were doing it, and we distributed out of there.
How did that work?
It worked great.
Yeah.
Still working today. It's working great.
Netherlands is a better choice than Belgium or...
Yeah, well, Netherlands was great. It was a perfect choice. Belgians, as you... fighting with each other right now, as you read in the paper, and the Dutch are very, very practical people, and they get things done.
Right.
The government and the individuals who worked at Amgen. Mm-hmm.
So you're at Amgen for 27 years,
right?
Yeah. Yep. Towards the end of that, you're thinking about you're still a young guy, relatively speaking, but you're not finished.
I was getting tired. It's okay to admit that. You get tired. It's been, you know, people talk about Amgen years, you know, every year at Amgen is like 5 years working somewhere else. I'm sure a lot of intense places say that. And I was getting tired. The place was changing a lot, even more, turning more into a pharmaceutical type environment. And
what did that mean for you?
For me, it meant I spent all my time in meetings and not anywhere near the technology or the people I was leading. You know, you gave your speech at the podium and then you got in the corporate jet, Amgen's private jet, and flew home. You know, I didn't have time to spend any time with the leadership of places.
Yeah.
You know, you do an operating review, okay, fine, and you leave. You don't, I used to go and hang and wander around and, you know, get to know people. So it wasn't fun, and then Amgen was going through a down, and I was going to have to start firing a lot of people. Frankly, I just didn't have the stomach for
it. You saw that coming.
Yeah.
And you hadn't had to do that before.
You know,
you did a little bit of it, right?
Here and there. You did some of it, sure. I had no problem letting people go who weren't good, or if I had to downsize by 3%. Okay, you know, you stack rank and you figure out. But this was going to be something different. And that's when Amgen went through its major shrinkage. And I just didn't have the energy for that. I told Kevin, I said, look, I'm not having fun, and this isn't going to be fun, and I don't have to work, so I'm going to go. So we parted on... Amgen and I walked away in great and very good terms, you know. I hung around and, you know, helped the transition to a guy who worked for me. So that was fine. So it was one of my staff got the job, and he did a great job after I left. So somebody I worked with, so...
Right. Well, you're tired, and what are you thinking? What's next? Did you have a plan?
I thought about going to work for real, but I had some fun, you know. Scuba going next week to St. Thomas scuba diving. That's fun. And then I started doing corporate boards. I had done one corporate board when I was at Amgen, Averon. And then I said, you know, this is sort of fun. It's like you're kind of working, but you're not. There's not a lot of stress involved. I'm fortunate enough to, you know, poor CEOs have more stress, and I'm there to help them. So I sit on five corporate boards now, five public boards.
And you feel like you make a good contribution?
I try.
By virtue of your lengthy experience?
Exactly. Yeah. I always say I've made a lot of mistakes. Let me help you. Let me see if I can help you not make those mistakes.
Yeah.
So,
anything particularly interesting, problems that you run into with these companies?
You can look up their... Dendrion's going through some major challenges right now. I'm on Dendrion's board. You know, I'm on a company called Xenoport. It's got challenges. A company called Kythera just went public, and it's got Betnol. That's in the cosmeceutical space, facial contouring, something very different. But a friend of mine from Amgen started it, so it's like old Amgen when I go back there, so that's fun. I'm lead director there. And I'm on also Hospira board, which is a large company, and I'm enjoying working with those large issues again, like Amgen had, you know, the big people issues and big investment issues. So, yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
I think working a day or two a week is just perfect.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, about a week, day or two a week.
What do you do the rest of your time?
Live in Malibu.
Yeah.
I love the water. I surf, I scuba dive, I hit the gym a lot, I rest, I read.
Yeah.
Travel. My wife and I like to travel, so it's good.
Yeah. So, when you came out here, where did you live originally? Were you up in
Thousand Oaks? I was up in Thousand Oaks, yeah. And we lived around there, and when I retired, my wife thought it'd be best, and she was right, you know, get a little distance from the place, and he moved to Santa Barbara for a little while, and didn't stick up there that well. So then, basically then moved to my beach house, which is on the water down here, and spent most of the time there. So I live, so now I have a house on the beach here, which I spend all summer at. House in Santa Barbara I visit occasionally. It's a small, you know, town home. And then we just bought a house back up in Thousand Oaks. Why? Because that's where all our friends are. So, I mean, you're probably the only guy who's got three houses in one area code. You know, but that's all right. Amgen's been very good to me.
Yeah, and your friends are probably a lot of Amgen people.
Correct.
There's a current Amgen community.
Yeah, there's a lot of us are retired, so we go hiking. You say, what do I do? What am I doing tomorrow? I'm going hiking for 8 hours with a couple of retired Amgen guys.
Where are you going?
Oh, these mountains around here are fantastic for hikes. Yeah, they're just great. And then some of them are still working. They're younger guys. I was hanging around yesterday with two guys who are working, and I've been had a good time. So yeah. So I have a large personal network of Amgen former and current employees.
Well, have we covered everything?
You know, I always feel I don't do justice to such a great company. Especially, you know, I don't know what you're going to sort of talk about the early days, I imagine, more.
Well,
by the way, I didn't start by saying I very much enjoy your magazine. I love it. I read it.
Oh, great.
And it's balanced. It's messy.
Yeah.
It's not like here's some corporate story about Hypertech and it's great. It's
right.
A lot of disagreement, and you're actually right. People have different memories of this event. Here's what this guy said. Here's what that guy said.
Yeah.
Truth somewhere in here. So I really love the way you lay it out. It's not pretty and it's not perfect, and we don't have perfect records.
It's what we're aiming for. It gets a little uncomfortable sometimes when people, you know, when people know the truth, and you know, there's two or three different truths that we have to negotiate.
You know, honestly, everyone sits there, you know better, you're a writer, so we all have a version of what happened.
Yeah.
And we reinforce it in our brain over 20 years.
Yeah.
What really happened in that meeting? I don't know. I mean, I know what I think, but somebody else might say something different.
And so we have to get multiple accounts.
You have to.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy that. And I saw Alan Mendelsohn, and saw he was on it, and I'm on a number of boards with him. And cleaning the scripts down in San Diego, not for profit. And I said, Alan, there's no one from Amgen here. What the heck's going on? And he said, well, you could be. You know, you want to get involved. So I made a small donation, and I'm glad you guys are going to work the Amgen story in at some point.
Yeah, great. Good.
So you're based in San Francisco?
We're in San Francisco. It's a good place to be.
It is. Biotech hub of the universe.
Right. And then, you know, we can get down here to Thousand Oaks, San Diego. It's just a
flight
going
away.
To Boston is a little
tired for Genzyme and those early stories.
Mm-hmm.
The one question you didn't ask me, but I'm sure Kirby will come up with the same answer if you ask him. Why is Amgen at Thousand Oaks?
Well, I think I've heard, and I forgot who... It had something to do with, I think, with the Caltech guys, and there was something...
Exactly.
Go ahead, give me
exactly. So, Bruce Wallace, the first employee, unfortunately, who passed away in a hang glide accident.
Yeah.
I came and I said, you know, I said I'd known this area. I'd stopped at Newbury Park for lunch on one of my vacations. I said, this is a nice place, you know. It was really rural back then. I went to the beach here, and I said, pretty close. So I was like, why are you here, Bruce? And he's the guy who picked it. He said, well, I had three powerful SAB members, one in Santa Barbara, one in UCLA, and one in Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wanted it next to their campus.
Yeah.
This is exactly 50 miles from all three of them. So literally, this predates George Rathman's decision. He and Winston said, okay, we'll put it right in the middle, and they found Thousand Oaks.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's the only reason. And what a great, to think back to it, when people weren't happy at Amgen, which happens in all companies, and you're up in the Bay Area, you just say, screw to your boss, drive the other direction, and get another job. Your kids don't change schools. No one moves.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you were in. You know, your wife says go back to work and make it work because I'm moving the kids. They're in high school or whatever, right? You know, so that it was hard to attract people. But once you got them, you had them.
Well, that's interesting. I imagine there've been plenty of companies sort of spun out of Amgen. Maybe not
many. It's funny.
Well, what about other? But some people have gone on to do some stuff. Have any been located?
If you look, we have spun out almost no companies, and the only one of the few is this company called Kythera. And the venture capitalist asked me, he said, what is it about the culture at Amgen, unlike Genentech? I said, because, you know, usually you go to some venture capitalists and they say, yeah, okay, we'll start a company, you've got to move to San Francisco. And no one wanted to move.
Uh-huh.
So you went back to work at Amgen because you said, I can't move. And then when guys left Amgen, we had done well enough, the first 1,000 of us, that no one had to work anymore. And there was very few guys who wanted to take on the challenge. Yeah. So Kythera, as far as I know, is the only spin out of Amgen people. And that was because the CEO, Keith Leonard, insisted that he didn't want to move either.
He said, it's
here. It's at Calabasas, right up the top of the road here. Uh-huh. And he insisted to stay close. So Amgen hasn't been very good at spinning out stuff. And, you know, I don't know if it's cultural. We all got lazy and didn't want to do new things after we got done. Or usually the venture capitalists don't like to travel down here. They want to stay up in San Francisco or Boston or something.
Yeah, well, I know it's a problem down in San Diego that there's... I mean, they put a lot of companies there, but it's tough because the capital isn't there, really.
Right. I was on a small board of board of a company in Santa Barbara. Great company, technology out of UCSB. And the VCs came in, they said, okay, item number one, we'll make an investment, you're moving. I was like, wait a minute, you can build a company, you can't build a company. I said, well, they did, right over there in Thousand Oaks. What makes you think you can't do it here? Well, it's too hard to get here, is what they said.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you got to make a connection through LAX. I'm not doing that, you know. So they moved it to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was it.
Well, thank you, Dennis.
Oh, you're welcome. And happy to chat with you anytime. Also to assist making connections. Mike Downing, you were interested. He'd be good on the J&J Wars.
Yeah.
Jeff Brown lived them, and he's the guy.
Okay.
All right? You got to talk to.
Right.
And I've lost his contact information.
Well, we'll find it.
Bob Andron might have it. I'm going to send out some emails now. Who else do you need? Brown? Downing?
Yeah. I don't have
send me an email.
I will. Okay,
because then I'll just keep iterating against my friends, and somebody will have those two guys. And if there's anybody else you want me to connect with, Larry Souza, everybody's lost contact with him, so I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't help you.
Well, I'll keep after him.
And he'll have his own view. It'll be very different than everybody else's. He'll have his own strong view. Good. All right, I'll let you end your flight.
All right, well, we'll get a transcript back to you so you can...
I can listen to the babbling, yes.
Well, you can do whatever you want with it. You know, add, delete, correct, whatever.
So, when's your flight?
At 7 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I got plenty of time.
We got good time.
And we're also writing a book about... Okay. It will be about the origins of the industry up till about, I think, 1990 is when they've got the beginnings of this thing. Around 1990 is when... Okay, yeah, it's here to stay, and a lot of that has to do with these two drugs from Amgen. But that's the book, and of course, Amgen's going to be a big part of that. I'll send it to you, and you can review it. No obligation.
Oh, no, I'd love to, again, I got plenty of time now.
Okay,
And I love, we got to get the history of this thing right. People will make it up if we don't write it down,
right? That's right.
Yep. So I think it's really important. So you know Pitch Johnson.
Yes.
Well, you've talked to him, because I know Pitch well, and he'll... happily chat with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Bill Bowers is not well. So
well, we've talked to Bill.
I haven't talked to him in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, those two guys, obviously, huge in Amgen's history.
Right.
And they were on the board for a long time, so I had the honor and privilege of getting to know them.
Yeah, well, do you have any stories about those guys? That they were influential?
They were a presence.
How did they work with George Rath?
Well, I believe, no, I wasn't, you know, at that point in my career, I was in and out of board meetings.
Yeah, yeah.
You go in, you do your spieling, you're out
right,
the door, right?
Yeah.
You know, go get the money and run, you know,
right.
Make a presentation. But when I got to be, you know, as a senior vice president, they were still active board members. They were still a presence to be dealt with, and they were leaders of that board and pitched stayed on for a long time.
Yeah.
And they even extended the retirement age for him. And they were very stabilizing influence, you know. Just, you know, you hit rough patches all over the place, and those guys have, you know, seen the ups and downs of so many companies, and they were always like, you know, you'll get through this, just forge ahead. And too bad you can't interview George for this. It's a shame.
Well, there is a good oral history. I'll send it to you because it's a great thing. Sally Smith Hughes, she's a historian at
right.
UC Berkeley.
And
it is oral history of George Rathman. It's a great document. I'll send it to you.
I am intensely unhappy that Amgen wouldn't give you the oral histories that we all did.
Well, we can get. I think it's just a matter of formatting. They just have. I guess they're on. I don't know. Betamax tapes or something. I don't know.
Oh, is that what it was? I thought they were afraid that there was something in there that they didn't want heard. But
yeah, no, I don't think so. But I think we'll get to them eventually. But it's good for us to sit down with people. And
yeah.
Because
I was the principal guy on that 25th book, and it was fun doing that. But let's just say not all the issues were fully explored
right.
in it. It was
yeah.
the corporate version, so
right.
I had to be careful.
Yeah.
But it is over. But the oral histories would probably give you a lot more
yeah.
nitty gritty. I know they would because I heard them when I was helping. What's Duncan? Right? You write it. So,
oh right, yeah, Dave Duncan.
Yeah. You know him?
Yeah. I met him. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I was helping him write it. You know, he had to leave some parts, some of the juicier parts.
All right.
But you can put them in.
Right.
I'm just not paying.
Thanks, Dennis.
All right.
Great.
That's
great story.
Good.
Okay.
All right.
We'll be in touch with you.
Thank you.